Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to the April edition of Wireless, a series all about radio broadcast on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. And a warm welcome as ever to all our listeners on other community stations throughout Ireland. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital broadcasting, community, regional and national broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate radio, podcasting, radio activism and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on this edition of Wireless, how is community radio and radio in general in the UK dealing with the COVID-19 crisis? The hobby of DXing explained. A manifesto for community radio from almost 40 years ago, and we learn about the concept of entangled media histories.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
But first to COVID-19, and as you know, we've broadcast special extra programmes over the past month looking at how radio in Ireland, Italy, Spain and France have been dealing with the crisis. This month we turn to the UK, which has become one of the worst hit European countries, and we ask how radio there has been both reporting the pandemic and dealing with the threats posed by COVID-19 to the medium of radio. Chrissy Brand is a radio activist and journalist and also Secretary General of the European DX Council. We'll learn more about the hobby of DXing later, but first I asked Chrissy about a recent article written by her for Radio User magazine about how radio can contribute to activism.
Yes, well, I guess I'm also a political activist. I have been for ages, as well as a journalist, and the editor of the magazine wanted me to marry up the two. This stemmed from a book written in the US about 2005, I think, called How Internet Radio Can Change the World. And what I was trying to concentrate on was organisations that don't really get the exposure on mainstream media, even on mainstream radio. So everything from organisations everyone's heard of, like Greenpeace and Extinction Rebellion, to more perhaps progressive or radical groups, and how you can, in this day and age, people power, I suppose, anyone can set up a podcast or a radio station, an internet radio station particularly perhaps, and try and get their message across to build campaigns and to just get views represented that are quite often reduced to sound bites on RTE, BBC, etc., if they're even mentioned at all.
Obviously then, in the case of the pandemic, radio in a way has come into its own and is stepping up to the mark, being a medium that's very perhaps suited to dealing with an emergency.
Yes, that's right. I think, throughout history, with radio's long history of over a century now, it's always been a good medium to turn to, and I think people can listen to radio, obviously, the car or in the home, but now under lockdown people are probably tuning in more and more, and as well as the little sound bites and phone-in programs that are quite perhaps sensationalist, there are stations that have come out of nowhere really that are broadcasting programs about the virus. I was interested that on shortwave, for instance, we had a couple of stations that have gone off the air altogether, but then there's others programs that have come up. The International Radio Relay Station that's based in Milan, for instance, is now running a 24/7 update relaying a lot of American public radio and then British news and other news. So radio's there, but it's also the flip side, I think, is that radio can act as a diversion, because I don't know about everyone else, but I find I can get too much information about the virus, and then it can send you into almost panic mode. So it's nice to be able to go to the radio for music or drama, or listen to podcasts that are quite humorous or zany, and just to get away from it, as well as to be able to select what information you want to hear about it.
And how do you think British radio has been dealing with covering the COVID-19 pandemic on the one hand, and how has it been coping itself with the changes in the economy that have been brought about as a result of the lockdown?
Yeah, well, I think I imagine it's not that different from any other country that's suffering at the moment. It's been interesting to see how quickly that lots of radio stations have been able to get people, presenters, DJs, presenting from home. A lot of people have home studios or can set up their own little station at home. So that's been good, the way that it's been able to adapt and rejigging some of the schedules so that perhaps, for instance, BBC Radio 5 Live overnight has now dropped one of its programmes and is relaying another programme instead to across the whole country. I think radio in many ways, there's a lot of phone-in still and some coverage, as usual, tends to be a bit populist and sensationalist and tending to blame people for going for walks rather than perhaps looking at government policy or lack of government organisation and being prepared or doing enough about it. But I think generally the radio I've heard, particularly from international stations like Radio Sweden and Prague and Deutsche Welle, has been, I always turn to those stations for reliable information anyway, and they've obviously continued to give that. It's interesting though, I think that what's one of the things I'm concerned about perhaps is that everything else has been dropped. Obviously this is the biggest story in peace in our lifetimes, probably in peacetime in general, but all the other problems of the world are still there and still need to be reported on and addressed perhaps, but I guess that will happen more as we begin to come out of lockdown.
And how has British community radio been responding as far as you have been able to hear? I mean, you mentioned populism and sensationalism perhaps on some of the larger stations. I think of maybe an outlet like LBC would perhaps have that reputation. But how has British community radio been covering the pandemic?
Well, from what I've seen, I think it's been quite good in that it fosters, by its very name, very sort of local connections and is being supportive. So where I live in Hastings on the south coast, for instance, we've got a local network, Hastings Emergency Action and Response Team, HART. So other community radio stations I've seen, or heard rather, are signalling people, signposting people to local groups where they can get people to go and do their shopping or pick up prescriptions, or people can volunteer. So it's brought, community radio already does this, but instead perhaps of promoting village fairs at the weekend or school fetes and all this kind of thing, it's bringing people together in a situation of crisis and actually giving them more connections with each other. So I think that's been good. Although that's for the point of view of stations that are already on the air. Again, talking locally, we have probably the longest restricted service license station in the UK is Hastings Rock, which runs for a month each year, but that's due up on the air in May, but they're just going to have to do it as an online station because they can't set up the studios, can't set up the transmitter equipment. So there's that knock-on effect for stations that are either coming to the air or need to maintain equipment, I guess.
Absolutely. And in terms of the political position then of British community radio, I mean, it's been said for a long time that the Irish community radio sector isn't particularly radical, perhaps compared to other countries. How political is British community radio, or how restricted is it in its activist stance that could perhaps be interesting and useful at a time like this?
Yes, I mean, my experience, I've been interviewed on community radio in the Northwest before when I was living up there. And I was invited to go on to talk about austerity, or the People's Assembly Against Austerity and various actions that they were putting on. And I was briefed beforehand that I mustn't mention the word austerity or the cuts. So I just had to talk about measures that the government was implementing. So I think even if a community radio station and its personnel have a certain political view, they're very wary of being seen to be either one-sided or to give one view, because they feel that they will get complaints, or their funding will get cut if they get any funding at all, or that they'll be taken off the air. So I think there's a fear factor really on a lot of community stations, and most of them, I would say, are apolitical. They just report the news locally, and national news and international news is just the same as the mainstream stuff that you get, from what I've heard anyway.
So to come back to your article then, would you see different forms of radio perhaps being better equipped to foster activism in terms of some of the issues that are of concern to you?
I think perhaps less radio, but more podcasts, because it's very difficult for organisations to get, say, for instance, Stop the War Coalition and other groups that the British government has labelled as terrorist groups in recent times, which they're clearly not terrorist groups, they're just opposing some of the policies, but they would never have a platform on a conventional radio station. So more and more organisations are taking to the ever-growing podcast market to produce podcasts and to build audiences amongst their supporters and members from that. And one of the things that's come out of the current situation under lockdown is that I attend a lot of political meetings generally, but I'm going to one every night at the moment, because you have lots of different organisations streaming things on Facebook Live, where you have a series of speakers all sitting in their own sitting rooms or kitchens or home offices talking about these issues. So I think, although there are some programmes on some, say, American stations, you might get an hour's programme a week talking about climate change or animal rights or 101 other things, or Black Lives Matter. You don't really get that in the UK, and I'm not that aware, even throughout Europe, if there's that many stations that would give over an hour a week of programming to something that is considered radical, but it's not really radical at all.
Are you thinking of an equivalent to Democracy Now, perhaps?
Yeah, Democracy Now is a good example. But how many people actually get to hear that, I don't know. But there are sort of local radio stations in the States that do have the odd program. But then again, they quite often but they choose to play music. There's a station in Vancouver, I think it's called Co-op Community Radio. And they're great because they do this. I remember a few years ago, I went to Vancouver. And the previous day, I'd been at a People's Assembly demonstration in London. And it was ignored by the British media, but there I was listening to Vancouver radio, and they were reporting on it the other side of the world. So I suppose it's finding stations for people that want an alternative view to the mainstream. It's not that they necessarily disagree with the mainstream, they just want, it's just giving all sides of an argument. That's what I would really like to see more of.
I think there is one community station in Dublin, Near FM, who rebroadcast this programme, and they actually rebroadcast Democracy Now! I'm aware of that. So perhaps there are other Irish community stations in the same position. Just to come back to what you said there, Chrissy, about attending political meetings on Facebook Live and people producing podcasts. These are not traditionally radio as we know it. Obviously, Facebook Live is very far from radio in that it's a major multinational corporation of immense political and economic power, despite attempts perhaps to restrain that, which haven't been very successful. Obviously, podcasts are more independent, but both of these are moving away from what we would have known radio to be. And, some of them are very definitely not radio. So what does that say about the role of radio in these questions in general?
It's interesting, isn't it? I suppose it's a combination of technology always evolving, and these days anybody can set up their own podcast or Facebook live stream. The trick is trying to get people to listen to it or watch it. So there's that side of things, and it's hard to get on the radio in the first place as a presenter, and then it's probably even harder to stay on the radio without saying anything controversial. So I have two views on it, really. As a bit of a traditionalist and growing up in an era of radio and enjoying that, and listening to obscure stations throughout the night, which I still very much enjoy, I think there's just a way of accessing information now that is probably more key. So radio, the fact that a few years ago radio stations installed webcams, or a lot of them, in their studios, so you can watch radio as well as this taking it in the traditional form. So I think it's just a case of having to adapt, although I don't want to argue against the case for traditional linear radio, because that is a great companionship and a great source of happiness for most people, I imagine, still.
So it's an interesting point, because in the previous era, or perhaps even to some extent in the current era still, a pirate radio station perhaps would have fulfilled some of the gaps that you're talking about before the advent of Facebook Live and so on. I've done a lot of work on the Irish pirate radio scene as a former pirate myself. It still exists in Dublin to a certain extent, and I know in London as well. So there is still a pirate radio scene, perhaps still carrying that flame.
Yeah, I think so. I suppose there's also a kind of romance, or the fact that it's operating on the fringes of the law. So that's quite exciting. And also, I listen to a lot of the London pirates. There are pirates in Manchester. We even have a couple here on the South East Coast from time to time. It's a way of promoting different music, new music that isn't being played on regular radio. I'm sure the people that drive it are obviously huge radio fans and probably like the idea of transmitting out to an unknown audience, and you can capture a wider audience out on FM, whether they want to hear you or not perhaps, than you can by having a little podcast or internet radio station that you then got to create an audience for. So I think, yeah, and a lot of pirate radio stations, obviously, well, certainly in the UK, a lot of presenters cut their teeth there and then end up on more local or mainstream national radio. So it's like an apprenticeship for some, as well as always being an alternative way of communicating. But the pirate radio stations I've always heard tend to be music rather than, or music based, and bands and artists they can't hear on regular radio, rather than it being any sort of talk based or political view.
Yes, I think the radical edge of pirate radio has perhaps diminished, although they still serve musical genres and styles that are underserved or not served at all by mainstream radio. So perhaps it's an indirect form of serving an ignored group or an underrated genre of music or so on. We're speaking to Chrissy Brand, who is Secretary General of the European DX Council and also a journalist working in the field of radio and sound. And Chrissy, that's what I want to come to now, is your official title and your work with the European DX Council. So for listeners who are not familiar with the concept of DXing, could you give us a general overview of the hobby and its origins, its history a little bit?
Of course, yeah. Well, radio, as we probably all know, started or was in its infancy around 100 years ago. And lots of stations came to the air and people started to have very basic radio receivers. And would hear wonderful things, whether it's from a local station or often across the Atlantic Ocean or parts of Europe. And DX itself is a term that stands for distance X, which means distance unknown. So DXing is the act of hearing a radio station from a long distance. And at the same time, radio stations had no idea at the time really how far their signals were getting out. So they would rely on listeners to contact the station to tell them how particularly, you know, there was medium wave and then short wave, but people would be listening to them and not knowing what the audiences were beyond their local target area. So DXing suddenly became of interest, I guess, in the 1920s onwards, when people were finding these interesting stations to listen to and then finding other people who were also doing the same and forming clubs or societies and communicating with the stations. A couple of years ago, I was at the British Library, and there was an exhibition about recorded 140 years of recorded sound. That's what it was. And one of the exhibits there was the logbook of Alfred Taylor, who was a teenager in Derbyshire in the early 1920s, and he'd faithfully written down stations he's heard and what the programme content was and what the time was and how strong the signal was. And that's what DXs to this day still do. Although it's I suppose we're an ageing bunch in a way, because of the way radio has evolved and more people are listening to radio online if they choose to take radio that way. But it started probably with an interest for different sounds. The whole idea of listening to radio was a novelty back then, and it's just evolved from that. So the European DX Council formed as an umbrella organisation of all the national clubs in the 1960s, and it still exists today. It has an annual conference, and it's a nice social gathering, really.
And what's the attraction then? As you say, you can listen to radio online now. What's the attraction of listening in the linear way, and particularly picking up signals from afar, from distance X, as you say?
I think it's, well, for me, it started as a kid, really, listening to some grandparents' radios when I would be at their houses, and the excitement of seeing far-flung names on a lit-up radio dial. I think part of the appeal is seeking out information that you wouldn't hear when you turn the television on. Part of a feeling of being a select group of people, perhaps, who are getting that information. And I don't know, perhaps it's just something inherently primal about it, that you're sort of playing around with the dial and hearing the voice of someone on the other side of the world who's talking out there. It may be something that's possibly lost to anyone who has grown up in the internet age, and I accept that, but it was the excitement growing up, and I don't think that diminishes. Both the thought that you can be listening to something really obscure, that, I don't know, music from a Pacific island or from South America, and people talking in different languages. That's the big thing. I would just be turning the dial along the band and hearing voices in Polish or Czech or German. And it was just a way of engaging with the world beyond the little island that I live on. So I guess it's a whole range of things, really.
And do you have any memorable catches? Do you have any memories of listening to very far-flung stations that you didn't expect to pick up?
I guess I'm probably not as... I have friends who are far more expert in this and far more exciting catches than I've ever had, I guess, but... I do remember it in the early days, and even more recent times, listening to stations like Ecos del Torbes and Radio Rumbas from Caracas in Venezuela on the tropical bands. So that's around 5,000 kilohertz. Just the style of the programming, the big kind of booming, confident South American, Spanish voices with something. And then the music from, say, Mali, so... radio and television in Mali, that their broadcasts always appealed to me. And then stations like Radio Brass in Brazil, who aren't on the air anymore, but just listening to them in the 1980s made me want to go and travel to Brazil and around the world. So, and that's all shortwave. On medium wave, hearing stations from local stations from Canada and the US is exciting, because you just think someone is sitting in the studio talking to a little group of people in their vicinity, and this signal has somehow drifted across the oceans to you. I guess there's a romantic side to it all as well. Romance and travel, for me, more so than the technical side, because I would never say I'm particularly technically minded, but I just love the whole social interaction and the ideas of connecting with people around the world.
And the British DX Club, then, in which you're also involved, and you do a lot of work on their magazine Communication, which is very interesting. What are the main activities of the British DX Club?
Okay, well, the British DX Club was, like many, was founded many years ago. We started in 1974, and one of the co-founders, Dave Kenny, is still very active today. I joined in the 90s, but these days, well, in communication, we produce this monthly magazine, which has all the latest tips on radio, from community radio to international radio, and it features readers' logs. And we look back at the heritage as well, as because radio's got such a rich heritage now. It's been around for so long, and there's a lot to celebrate on that. We have social meetings when we're not under lockdown, a few a year. It's a social network, I would say, more than anything. But it also shares information, and it's of use to broadcasters and enthusiasts. And it's a nice way of putting together a group of people, because the whole traditional DXing is quite a solitary pursuit, really. It tends to be people sitting in the dark at the radios, perhaps not talking to each other, but not talking to people, but listening all the time. So it's an opportunity to pull that together. And we've got about 500 members at the moment. Obviously a lot of it mostly in Britain, but from all over the world as well. So it's just a nice way of showing that the radio and DXing is still out there. There's still a lot to be heard. There's still a lot of information to share with people.
And my last question then, Chrissy, relates to, you know, a key aspect of DXing, which is AM broadcasting. And obviously, you know, FM is holding its own, very much so in Ireland, to a lesser extent perhaps in other countries, but is holding its own generally internationally, whereas AM is in really a terminal state of decline. And this has big implications for DXing, I presume. But is there anything that can be done to save AM broadcasting? Does it still have a role in the future, for instance, in terms of maybe micro-broadcasting, even as an opportunity for pirates to return to the air? Not, of course, that we're actively encouraging that on this programme.
Yeah, well, obviously AM, as you say, has had a huge decline, particularly with throughout a lot of European countries like France and Germany, and even in recent years. These days, if you listen to medium wave, there's a lot of Spanish stations and there's a big Hungarian signal. I think when stations leave the air, it does give a chance to, when they vacate a frequency, you can still tune to that frequency and perhaps hear a station from further afield, like, say, a station in Romania that was occupying a frequency at the same time as a British station, because a lot of the BBC local radio stations have recently exited medium wave. So that gives an opportunity to hear stations on medium wave you wouldn't normally hear. I think one of the knock-on effects of the virus will be that radio is going to be in a parlous state economically, like every other part of society. So I do fear that some medium wave stations, even shortwave stations, may have the plug pulled on them. But we have a lot of micro broadcasting stations on DAB in the UK. But I would like to see more having the opportunity to broadcast on a medium wave, because, as you say, that's there, and there's lots of frequencies. It may well encourage some pirates as well, I don't know. It would be a shame to see it go to waste, really.
Chrissy Brand, radio activist, journalist and Secretary General of the European DX Council, talking to us about the hobby of DXing, and before that, how British radio is dealing with COVID-19. You can learn more about DXing at edxc.org.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
We've been busy over the past few weeks adding more material to the Irish Pirate Radio audio archive at pirate.ie, and we now share with you a fascinating insight into the philosophy of community radio in Ireland almost 40 years ago in 1983. There were several community radio stations on air in Ireland at the time, and while they were all essentially pirates in the legislative vacuum of the 1980s, a movement for licensed community radio was building up steam. This recording from the 27th of March 1983 is from one such station, Concord Community Radio in Dublin. The station plays a message from another station, Bray Local Broadcasting in County Wicklow, which was leading the campaign for community radio.
All right. But right now on Dateline Dublin, we're going to take a short tape that Bray Local Broadcasting made on a similar programme to this one some weeks ago, in which they express their point of view. This tape has been made by Bray Local Broadcasting.
It seems that we've been talking about local radio in Ireland for years now. Every so often, the subject comes up for discussion, and the debate usually revolves around two possible options: the RTE proposals and commercial radio. Seldom is community-run radio discussed. Certainly, lip service is paid to it by both sides, but we really yet to hear it discussed openly in the larger media. Why? Well, because the larger media is controlled by both sides in the debate so far. The third option not being discussed is perhaps the most relevant solution to Ireland's present local radio dilemma. Let's look at the three options. We make no apology for saying more about the third, as it's seldom represented. Commercial radio quite simply exists to return a profit to its owners. It aims at a mass market to maximise its ratings for better advertising sales. Minority or very varied programming is simply not on when private profit comes first. In commercial radio, all popular music and a move towards complete automation is the trend elsewhere. Business groups will be very keen to get the franchise for Dublin, Cork and the large population areas. Experience in the UK has shown that the trend in commercial radio is blandly similar up and down the country, looking for increased transmitter power with a subsequent increase in geographical area. It's been suggested that commercial radio provides a different choice of music locally and not much else. As for the smaller population areas, will they be seen as commercially viable? What about Dublin and local radio? How many different communities can you identify in the greater Dublin area alone? One of the models suggested for the development of commercial radio in Ireland is the UK one, but Ireland has less population than the area served by one so-called local station in London. Would it be unfair to suggest then that the UK local radio experience has no real relevance here, other than to show us how not to organise ours? Commercial radio should be treated separately, a different broadcasting sector from genuine local broadcasting in Ireland. RTE has proposals for a nationwide community network to be implemented over a five-year period. Initially, the proposals were for provincial transmitting centres linked to towns in each area. For example, Wicklow, Dungarvan, Waterford, Wexford, Thurles, etc. would share a powerful transmitter and opt in when and as they could. That plan was published in 1979. Since then, it has been considerably updated and now proposes a county-based transmitter network with perhaps up to 20 centres. This system could come under the present RTE authority control, but it has been said that it would need an increase in the present TV licence fee to finance it. RTE has put much effort in promoting the concept of community radio since its mobile station started in the early 70s. A criticism levelled at RTE's proposal is that it is a view of community radio from the top down. In a recent Irish Times article, Father Joyce of Kilkenny Community Radio said, and I quote, "Community radio is a microphone in the community, reflecting its life and vitality. It is people being what they are, living out what they are, rather than someone coming in, rendering a service to them," end quote. Perhaps the RTE proposal could be described as RTE holding that microphone in front of the people, rather than allowing the people to find their own community and run community control radio for themselves. It's a view from Dublin, or at least controlled from Dublin, something many groups interested in community broadcasting outside Dublin are all too familiar with. Why, they say, should they support a plan that is said to take 5 years to implement and is supplied from Dublin, when they already know what they need in community broadcasting opportunities?
During an election interview for BLB, Taoiseach Gareth Fitzgerald had this to say.
And we're also, I may say, committed to local broadcasting being community organised and not controlled by large groups from outside the community in question.
So what is the third option? And what is genuine community-controlled radio?
Peter Lewis, author of a report entitled Models of Structure and Finance in Community Radio, published in 1977 by the International Institute of Communications.
The important things are that there should be real community control, if not ownership. That communications is like education or the health services or planning. It's just too important to be left to the professionals alone, really. it isn't such a mystery now. Technology has made it quite simple and really quite cheap. And there's a real extent to which what's being pumped out from the capital cities of any country, in Western countries, or indeed from mid-Atlantic positions, that we're having to consume products that are churned out from, as it were, factories that really have nothing to do with our own existence. And even local and regional news, in England anyway, is provided through the framework of professional viewpoint based on Fleet Street values. Now, it's only when people come to do it for themselves, in their own locality, they know what the news is, and they gather it using their own values, that I think you get a reflection of that community played back to itself. It's like any other art form, like local music, local drama, and community newspapers, and so on.
A community station is a forum for local issues, culture, and activities. It can be as varied as the town it is part of, and is only limited by how representative its members are. There is a tremendous willingness towards self-help projects in Ireland. People are beginning to realise that they can no longer look to Dublin or central government to provide everything. And there are many examples of successful locally run self-help projects that could not otherwise have been completed without full local support. The development of a genuine local radio sector can ideally be planned this way. People are quickly realising that there is no great mystery to broadcasting. It's one thing the unlicensed stations have proved. You don't need a team of experts arriving to do it for you. Community broadcasting gives perhaps a gentle introduction to a technological age that has made such broadcasting so simple. A station's locally defined output provides a much friendlier information source and promotes, more acceptably, a sense of shared concern for communities' problems. Local issues discussed by local people without the filter of professional media is what community broadcasting is all about. To quote a report published in 1977 concerning the future of broadcasting, local broadcasting is a different animal from network broadcasting, and so requires a different sort of keeper. Local radio has quite a different kind of relationship with its community, and the community has, and should have, an almost proprietary feeling about its local station that it cannot have about a national network. Local control and local financing, which is ultimately the key to local control, is seen by community broadcasters as the distinctive difference between community radio and that provided nationally. A station which exists to serve local needs as defined by local people, and which has been developed by sharing and programming production and policy decisions, helps place the community in the role of subject. Another report on community radio structures from around the world describes many successfully operating and genuinely community-controlled stations on the air today. It's just not true to say that radio must be either state or commercial. The report goes on to say, stations work hard at demystifying broadcasting and practice an informality on the air and in their handling of operations and scheduling. They rely on volunteers and deliberately attempt to train and involve those normally excluded from the mass media, such as minority groups, women, the poor, the elderly, and young people. Much criticism is levelled at the idea of operating community stations as voluntary organisations. These criticisms usually come from commercial vested interests. In Ireland, they are those who would wish to run local radio as a business for private profit. Volunteers are the lifeblood of community radio, providing the stations with their tremendous diversity of programming and viewpoints, and making it possible for community stations to present a full service. It is the volunteers who bring community into community radio. Technology now assists community-controlled local radio. Easily operated, good quality and reliable equipment is available. Many model structures are available for intending groups, and simple training programs are already taking place. Surely this third option, the most genuine form of community broadcasting, should be considered. There must be room for community radio. Otherwise, we may end up with a few large commercial stations and, perhaps, RTE trying to provide local radio in the commercially unviable areas. Community-controlled public radio is now in operation elsewhere. Why not Ireland?
The voice of Alwyn Dixon of Bray Local Broadcasting explaining the campaign for community radio as heard on another station, Concord, in Dublin on the 27th of March 1983. And you can hear more archived pirate recordings at pirate.ie.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
And finally, to historical media research and how it's linked to broader issues of culture and society. Dr. Hans-Ulrich Wagner is a professor at the University of Hamburg and a researcher in radio history. In this interview, he explains his involvement with a group of researchers who specialise in what they call entangled media histories.
This is a network between Bournemouth University in UK, Lund University in Sweden and Hamburg, and we decided to work more on this concept of entanglement. This is something new, or when we started 3 years ago, it was really brand new. Now it's somehow a boom in entanglement. Several persons do entanglement in their research, and it's about some tricky things. That means that you cannot deal with one entity anymore. That when I try to explain what entangled media histories are, then I always say, let us tell me in three sentences. One sentence about entanglement, one about media, and one sentence about histories in order to explain the approach. Do you want me to explain in three sentences?
Yes, please do. Maybe a little bit more than three sentences, but maybe okay. If you can take us through the three key words, entangled, media, and histories.
Yeah. Let me start with three key words, entangled media history, and I always start with the first keyword that means media. And with media, I want to tell you that it's not only one single medium. I deal personally with the so-called media environment, that means all the media that are available at the time. The media ensemble, that means you look at something, I call it a social domain, and the media that are used by this institution or city or whatever the social domain is. And the third word is media repertoire, that means coming from the perspective of the user. Everybody uses a lot of media, not only newspaper, not only radio, and so on. And dealing with the scientific aspects means that you look for the media set, the media repertoire that it is used by individuals, by a group, and to analyze it. That means media is really media, not only a single medium. But the first sentence about entangled media histories. Now, when it comes to entanglement, this is somehow a tricky word because it comes from a development that is developed in French, histoire croisée, and that means that you have to be aware that you construct your object. It's not the research object itself. As a researcher, you construct it. So be aware of this relationship of your own perspective and this you want to analyze, and be somehow self-reflexive about the situation. Maybe your object is something that you construct, for example, as a white, middle-class European man. Maybe some other people would look at this completely different. Or is it a problem that you create in your European mindset, but it's not important for Asian people, or things like that? Reflect on what you are doing while doing research on what you called object. The object is not objective, you can say. And this is was developed in French by two French scholars, and this is part of entanglement as we think about. So the third keyword is histories. And I stress the plural. It's not one history, it's histories. And colleagues and I, we say, start with something, the familiar, make it strange, and tell different stories, different histories. There is not only one history you can tell, but you can, of course, with this set of perspectives you have now reflected on, deal with your research object and the various histories you can tell about this, or try to get the information, the various information from this object, from this topic you deal with. That's the complex thing. And always, please always think in terms of processes. This is an ongoing process of research. You have permanently reflect on what you do and what the object is and what is going on. The object 2 years ago, it's not the same object if I look now to it.
So can you give us an example of how you have applied this approach of entangled media histories to your own research, perhaps drawing on your presentation about Hamburg in the 1930s,
yeah,
here at the International Transnational Radio Summer School, or other examples that may be appropriate to explain this approach to your research?
Maybe I can take this sound document I had with me at this summer school, and this is a sound document of 1931. It's a 4 or 5 minute clip of the sound of Hamburg, the Hamburg Harbor Concert, promotion disc made for this series on the program, and really dealing with only this 5 minute document means that you have to tell a lot of things about this document. For example, medium. Yes, of course, we deal firstly with radio. It's a radio series, the Hamburg Harbor Concert. But I deal with a promotion disc that was always played on the radio fair in Berlin. So it's something different. And of course, this record of 31 is embedded in a lot of things that comes from reportage. This clip is about a promotion of what we can do with a microphone in our hands. And it celebrates the new possibilities of going abroad and transmitting voices, noises from the harbor outside, not in the studio, but from outside. And so bring in all these medial aspects of not only radio, but the media of the time, the media environment of the early 30s. It was end of Weimar Republic. 2 years later, the Nazi Reich started, things like that. And of course, who are the actors? Who is the presenter, the announcer, the reporter? What kind of social dimension is in this document? It is part of a promotion of the Hamburg Harbor. This was a partnership by the broadcasting station and the state government of Free and Hanseatic Hamburg. So they both decided to promote the economy of the port and to celebrate it. And all these aspects come in. And of course, as a Hamburg researcher, I have to reflect on my position, because I know Hamburg sounds, or maybe I know from the media, of course, only. And this I have to reflect. This is a sound of 31. Is it a characteristic sound of Hamburg, or is it a sound of port cities you can listen to in Amsterdam and in Sydney and in Shanghai as well? These are research questions I have in mind.
Very good. So we're going to listen to some parts of the sound document in a moment. So before we do that, Hans-Ulrich, can you tell us a little bit about the first extract that we're going to hear?
I think most characteristic is that there are a lot of noises recorded in this promotion disc. You will hear a lot of hoots of the ships coming in and going out. And the announcer, of course, explains this is the noise of the harbor. This is the sound of the harbor. And a lot of steaming boats, smaller boats, come in and go out.
Dinora grüßt vom Dampfer Hamburg, der Hamburg-Amerika-Linie, alle Hörer nah und fern, in Stadt und Land, an der See und auf der See, alle unsere Landsleute im Auslande und all unsere plattdeutschen Landslöt. Die Hamburg, die am Freitag von ihrer Reise nach New York zurückgekehrt ist, liegt an der Quaimauer im Kaiser-Wilhelm-Hafen. Wir stehen mit unserem Mikrofon auf der Peilkompassbrücke des Ozeandampfers, auf dem heute unser Hafenkonzert spielt.
So tell us about the next extract that we're going to hear now, Hans Ulrich.
This very prominent reporter tells you a lot about the things he sees, the panorama of Hamburg. So he describes the whole panorama being on the one of the steaming boats, and then he tells you this is the most famous church, St. Michael, with the tower and the bell, and then you have this panorama of this very beautiful city of Hamburg, and later on there is the working field where a lot of ships were rebuilt and things like that.
So we'll hear that clip now.
Von der Brücke der Hamburg haben wir einen prächtigen Überblick über einen Teil des Hamburger Hafens. Vor uns und neben uns liegen größere und kleinere Dampfer, die aus aller Welt kommen und in alle Welt fahren. Über die Dächer der Schuppen hinweg sehen wir auf die gewaltigen Werftanlagen von Blohm+Voss, die Wiege war für die größten Dampfer der Welt und die manches Schiff baute, das sich das blaue Band des Ozeans errungen hat, kürzlich erst die Europa des norddeutschen Lloyd. Dort hinten, nicht im Elbstrom an den Pfählen, die weiß leuchtende...
And then to the next extract from the sound document, can you explain its significance?
At the end, he praises the symphony of labor in the harbor, and this is a document of 31. So it's part of the Weimar Republic, the economy there, and it was somehow a boom phase at this moment. So he really celebrates the economy and tell all the people that this is a very wonderful thing, that now this booming atmosphere is here and you can listen to the Symphonie der Arbeit, the symphony of the labor.
Von Bord Musik, das alte Lied, mit dem der Seefahrer die Heimat verlässt. Dort zieht ein deutsches Schiff in die Welt hinaus. Der Hamburger Hafen wartet auf seine glückliche Heimkehr. Der Hafen mit seinem Rasseln der Winden, dem Knirschen der Kräne, dem Schnaufen der kleinen Motorboote, dem Rauschen der Kielwasser, dem Klopfen, Hämmern, Nieten und dem metallischen Klingen auf den großen Werften, das sich vereinigt zu einer Symphonie der Arbeit, zu einem Hohelied des unermüdlichen Schaffens.
So that's the final extract from this very interesting sound document from 1931, Hamburg. So you're interested in more than just radio, you're also interested in sound. Why is it important in your view to expand our understanding of radio studies in this way and to broaden it to sound in general?
Also radio studies are important for me because radio is the medium that is able to record. Because in former times you need a lot of equipment to make a record of something. Of course, I expand my field to sound history and gather all sounds that are available. But that means recorded sounds, and that's tricky because when it comes to amateur records, Have they been preserved up to now? Yes, sometimes you get something from amateurs. And of course, this is interesting. And then we do, of course, some field recording in order to gather noises and the sonic atmosphere nowadays in order to preserve it for future.
Hans Ulrich Wagner of the University of Hamburg explaining his research group on entangled media histories. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Wireless on Flirt FM. Join us again the next time for more radio news and features from home and abroad. I hope you'll join us then, but in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and on facebook.com/wirelessflirt. You can also listen to previous shows on wirelessflirt.radio.ie, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Until the next edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.